We're not looking for conflict, but I made absolutely clear that we will defend America's interest across the board.
President Biden shares his vision of Asia relations. It's Friday, April 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online. We're at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, New Zealand's new approach to Beijing, virtual diplomacy. Indonesians master religious diplomacy. Vaccinating Broadway. Leading the Smithsonian. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Through his first 100 days in office, U.S. President Joe Biden has preserved many key aspects of his predecessor Donald Trump's tougher approach toward China. Some U.S. allies in Asia, though, are still deciding whether to join Washington's effort to counter Beijing, as we hear from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
In his first speech to Congress, U.S. President Joe Biden mentioned one country more than all the others, China. Biden explicitly declared the U.S. is in a competition with China to win the 21st century, issuing a warning to its president, Xi Jinping.
I told him, we welcome the competition. We're not looking for conflict. But I made absolutely clear that we will defend America's interest across the board.
Under Biden, U.S. officials have confronted China over its military intimidation of its neighbors, controversial trade practices, and human rights abuses. In many ways, it's a continuation of Trump's approach, which led to the worst U.S.-China ties in decades. One big difference is that Biden has tried harder to get U.S. allies to join the cause. He recently held the first leaders' summit of an informal alliance the U.S. hopes can counter China. Even in that group, though, many are reluctant to directly confront Beijing. And some U.S. allies remain unsure about political turbulence in Washington, says analyst Robert Kelly.
I think a lot of them just took a wait-and-see approach to see if Trump was, you know, a really permanent, you know, sort of populist turn in American life or a one-off thing, and Trump lost.
Good to be back.
In a speech Wednesday, Biden said America is not only back, but is here to stay. Despite Biden's assurances, however, some allies aren't convinced the U.S. has fully put its America First ideals behind it, says South Korea-based Professor Park Won-gun.
South Korea and other U.S. allies, especially liberal democratic countries, we have to prepare for this changing the world order. That means we are living in the decline of the U.S. power, and how do we restore this kind of world order, and at the same time, how can we architect, design the post-American order? So that's the important question to the U.S. allies.
It's an issue at the top of Biden's agenda for Asia and elsewhere. How to convince the world that America is predictable again. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Much of President Biden's first address to the joint session of Congress late Wednesday was devoted to his domestic plan, as he pitched ambitious infrastructure and jobs projects while casting government as a force for good. The American presidential tradition was noticeably different in many ways due to COVID protocols. VOA's White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara joins us with more.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
It still has pageantry, but due to the pandemic, President Joe Biden's address to the joint session of Congress was attended by only 200 people instead of the usual 1,600. His main message to the American people, that democracy and government can still deliver. Thank
you. We're vaccinating the nation. We're creating hundreds of thousands of new jobs. We're delivering real results to people. They can see it and feel it in their own lives. Opening doors of opportunity, guaranteeing some more fairness and justice.
Biden pitched his $1.8 trillion American Families Plan to expand education and child care, financed partly through taxing wealthy Americans. That's on top of the $2.3 trillion infrastructure package he announced in March.
The American Jobs Plan is a blue-collar blueprint to build America.
Biden delivered his speech later than most presidents, not only because he wanted to prioritize the country's massive vaccination campaign, but also due to security concerns. Just 4 months ago, supporters of then-President Donald Trump stormed Congress to try to overturn Biden's victory. For the first time, two women flanked an American president during his address to Congress, Vice President Kamala Harris and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, second and third in line of succession, respectively, marking a historical milestone in U.S. politics. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. India struggles with COVID-19 vaccination campaign amid new infection and death rates. Biden rallies skeptical allies to get tougher on China. China launches main part of its first permanent space station. Delegation of powers to Thai Prime Minister raises concern of authoritarian turn. California man found guilty in $100 million Afghanistan fraud scheme. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our website. That's voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington with more VOA Asia. New Zealand says it is uncomfortable using the 70-year-old Five Eyes intelligence grouping, which includes the United States, Britain, Australia, and Canada, to criticize China. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports, some critics accuse the government in Wellington of selling out to Beijing.
The Five Eyes Alliance was formed in 1941 to share secrets during World War II. Now, however, disagreements within the US-led alliance are emerging about using the spy network to exert political pressure on China. New Zealand, the group's smallest member, has expressed reluctance to sign joint statements from its alliance partners, condemning Beijing's crackdown on the democracy movement in Hong Kong and its treatment of its minority Uyghur Muslim population in Xinjiang province. The declarations have infuriated China's government. New Zealand's Foreign Minister Nanaia Mahuta believes the Five Eyes Alliance isn't the best forum to voice those concerns.
Can I say we do value the Five Eyes relationship? We receive significant benefits from being a part of that relationship, and they are close allies and friends in terms of common values and principles. But whether or not that framework needs to be invoked every time on every issue, especially in the human rights space, is something that we have expressed further views about.
However, critics, including some British lawmakers and influential newspapers, have accused the government in Wellington of selling its soul to China. They accuse New Zealand, which earns about 29% of its export revenue from China, of choosing its economic ties with Beijing over a long-standing alliance with like-minded nations. Media commentators in New Zealand have described the dilemma, speak out against China and suffer economic damage, as Australia has found, or stay silent and see the end of a moral foreign policy of which the nation was proud. Australia experienced a decline in coal and wine exports to China due to tariffs and restrictions imposed by Beijing. Alexei Muravayev is the head of the Department of Social Sciences and Security Studies at Curtin University in the Australian city of Perth. He believes divisions within the Five Eyes network will benefit China.
When you see quarrels among long-established and trusted allies, it gives China confidence that its policies divide and rule, its policies of effectively buying people's and countries' loyalties through major investment, through special trade deals, through guaranteeing access to China's tourists, China's dollars, China's market, is working.
New Zealand is insisting the Five Eyes group remains vital for its border security, defence and cyber safety. It believes a broader coalition of countries is needed to address human rights concerns in China and elsewhere. Analysts believe that divisions within the intelligence alliance show how the West is struggling to manage the economic and military rise of China. Senior Australian and New Zealand government officials are due to meet next month to discuss the Five Eyes alliance and other bilateral issues. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, India's foreign secretary says imports of oxygen are a top priority, adding 40 countries have pledged their support as the country continues to see a spike in the daily number of COVID-19 cases. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We've made it to the end of the week. Thanks for joining us on VOA Asia. America's re-engagement with the world coincides with a weird new era, that of virtual diplomacy. Since the pandemic made travel unsafe, world leaders have taken their diplomacy digital, opening up new possibilities for engagement, but also new concerns about fairness and transparency, and the occasional awkward moment. VOA's Anita Powell follows the story, virtually, of course, and has more from Johannesburg.
Diplomacy can be fraught at the best of times. At the worst of times, like in the middle of a pandemic, when leaders can't meet in person to hash out important issues, it can be excruciating. By now, millions of people around the world know the awkwardness of virtual meetings. But in meetings of global importance, virtualization raises some serious concerns. Long ago, so in 2019, major summits commonly drew civil society groups, protesters, and space for the smaller players to gather. Now, with everything online, more people can watch. But, says Mandeep Tawana of Civicus, the Global Civil Society Alliance, fewer people can actually participate and enjoy their freedoms of assembly and expression.
And online, these rights should be as equally available as they are offline. So that's critical. Secondly, we are also urging that when meetings are being organized by intergovernmental institutions, multilateral bodies, and so on, that they try to reach a vast swath of people. But most importantly, I think internet should be recognized as a very important human right.
But virtual diplomacy isn't going anywhere soon, says Brooke Spector, a former American diplomat turned journalist who has lived in South Africa for decades. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken went fully virtual for his first Africa trip this week, spending a day zipping electronically between high-level meetings in Kenya and Nigeria. Spector says the top U.S. diplomat adapted quickly to the medium.
To the extent to which Tony Blinken shows the same kind of ability and warmth through the camera that the president can manage to do, is going to stand him in good stead, because this, I suspect, is going to be the way of the world for quite a while. There'll be a lot fewer international visits and a whole lot more international consultations by way of the electronics.
But Spector says, don't mistake the novel format for fresh, new, or even honest new content. One thing remains essential to diplomacy, no matter the medium: preparation. These engagements are just as rehearsed as they ever were, he says. Have to be.
Virtual diplomacy, it's like anything else. It's only as good as the staff work that precedes it. If it's entirely an open-ended discussion in which a dozen or more people are participating, the result is something approaching chaos.
Or whatever this was. Either way, until the pandemic ends, and maybe beyond, virtual diplomacy is the world we're living in. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Grave diggers in India worked around the clock to bury victims as India's total COVID-19 cases passed 18 million Thursday. India reported almost 380,000 new infections and more than 3,600 new deaths Thursday. You'll find this and all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, different races and religions sharing space as part of America's melting pot. Indonesian American Christians and Muslims in Philadelphia are doing just that. VOA's Alam Pernanen has more in this report, narrated by Nova Perwadi.
As religious minorities in Indonesia, Indonesian American Christians in Philadelphia wanted to extend a helping hand to Muslims, a religious minority in America.
Being a minority is not comfortable. And I've been experienced that back home in Indonesia.
In 2007, the Philadelphia Praise Center opened its space for local Indonesian Muslims who didn't have their own mosque at that time.
That was in the holy month of Ramadan. We got very confused because we did not have a mosque for Eid prayers.
So all congregants were here? So all my Muslim friends were here. They took off their shoes or sandals and put them on the stairs. And we broke our fasting together in the basement.
The Indonesian diaspora in Philadelphia numbers around 7,000 people, based on data from the Indonesian consulate in New York. Many of them, mostly Christians, migrated here after the 1998 race riots in Indonesia.
When I was studying for my master's degree here, at that time, I could not meet a single Indonesian. And when I moved here in late 2007, there were thousands of Indonesians.
But the goodwill gesture came with some challenges. Muslims, for instance, were uncomfortable worshiping in a space with a giant cross and statues of the Virgin Mary.
But at that time, during the Tarawih prayer, we covered up the cross.
Some Christians took offense at covering the cross.
The response from Indonesian Christian, as well the American Christian, that they were my friends, and they show that they're not agree with my decision, with our decision.
In 2008, Indonesian Muslims in Philadelphia founded their own mosque, Al Falah. But in gratitude for the solidarity shown in the previous year, the mosque has since invited Christian Indonesians for the traditional breaking of the fast at sundown.
We say, you know, we give greetings at Idul Fitri. They say Merry Christmas to us. I know that's a big controversy back in Indonesia. It's not a big controversy here because we respect to each other.
The annual International Religious Freedoms reports to Congress routinely paint a problematic picture of the treatment of religious minorities in Indonesia. But here in Philadelphia, where both Christians and Muslims have lived or are living the minority experience, both sides continue to live a more harmonious existence. For VOA's Alam Burhanan, I'm Nova Purwadi, VOA.
Making headlines in Asia, 33 artifacts smuggled from Afghanistan to the United States during two decades of war were delivered to the Afghan National Museum on Thursday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, in an effort to bring Broadway back into the spotlight, New York City opened a new COVID-19 vaccination center for Broadway stage and screen workers. It's at Times Square. Evgeny Maslov has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
I won't quit till I'm a star on Broadway.
Actors from the Jersey Boys musical performing in front of an audience on Times Square. Wearing face shields, the mini show marks the start of the vaccination process for Broadway stage and screen workers.
What it means in this city, the theater, the music, the dance, the film and TV, it is our expression of everything that is New York City.
When Broadway theaters closed in March 2020, the city lost an estimated $14 billion in Broadway revenue, and it left over 100,000 people jobless.
To have to prepare with an unknowing end has been something that's been mentally challenging, physically and emotionally challenging.
You know, there's nothing like playing live music with your friends for a live audience, so I can't wait to get back to it.
This vaccination center in Times Square marks the beginning of Broadway coming back to life. Susan Simpliner is a seasoned Broadway producer, but for now, she chose to volunteer here.
There are stagehands, there are wardrobe, hair people, musicians. Those are all backstage. And then front of house, you've got box office treasurers, you've got ushers, you've got porters and cleaners. So basically on a big musical, you could have as many as 200 people working on one show.
The center is equipped to vaccinate up to 1,500 people a day. The more performers and stagehands get vaccinated, the sooner Broadway will come back to life. And it's not just Broadway. It's the nearby hotels and restaurants and shops.
We want to gather again, and we want to tell stories in the dark. We cannot do that if we don't feel safe and if you don't feel safe. So the first step in that process is getting our vaccination shots, and the next steps will follow.
Theaters hope to reopen their doors by September and start the slow process of healing, accompanied, as everything here, by music and dancing. For Evgeny Maslov in New York, NRI's VOA News.
As travel begins to open up, Washington's Smithsonian Institution again becomes a popular destination. In 2019, Lonnie Bunch became the first African-American and first historian to become secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. That's the museum's highest office. After almost 18 months on the job, he's spoken with VOA's Julie Tabo to share the highlights and challenges of his tenure so far.
By unanimous vote, we have placed our trust in Lonnie G. Bunch III to be the 14th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution.
On November 1, 2019, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington installed Lonnie Bunch as its 14th secretary.
Congratulations, Mr. Secretary.
During his acceptance speech, Bunch shared a story about a 1960s road trip with his father.
He pulled in front of the Smithsonian, and then he said to me, "You could visit the Smithsonian and not worry about being turned away by the color of your skin." I have never forgotten that moment.
Bunch is the first African-American and first historian to hold the Smithsonian's highest office.
I think of my grandfather and grandmother. You know, they started out as sharecroppers. And she used to take in other people's laundry and scrub other people's floors so her children and grandchildren wouldn't have to. Well, because they changed the trajectory, I am where I am. And so I want to make sure that what I can do is help change other people's trajectories.
As secretary, Bunch oversees the world's largest museum, education, and research complex, with 19 museums and the National Zoological Park. He has worked at the Smithsonian for decades.
The goal of the museum is to make America better.
Previously, he was the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which has welcomed more than 6 million visitors since it opened in September 2016. The museum is devoted exclusively to exploring, documenting, and showcasing the African-American story and its impact on American and world history. It's home to a collection of 40,000 objects.
The one that resonates with me that makes me cry every day is Emmett Till's casket, mainly because I became close to his mother as I was getting ready to leave Chicago.
Till was a black teenager who was kidnapped and brutally murdered by white men in Mississippi in the summer of 1955. Bunch recalls the strength of Till's mother.
What I realized is that the casket was really not a way to talk about Emmett Till's broken body, but it was a way to talk about the strength of women. Now, here is a black woman at the worst moment of her life, said, "I will use that to challenge America, to reinvigorate or reignite the civil rights movement."
Since becoming secretary, Bunch has had to grapple with the challenge of the pandemic, which has forced the museums to close and focus more on their online presence.
We knew at the Smithsonian that we needed to be more digital. And if you have 39, 40 million people come to your door every year, you're like, wow, that's pretty good. But that's a small percentage of what could come to you digitally. It's been a moment where it's allowed me to begin to think about reimagining the Smithsonian, reimagining our educational output, reimagining how we serve the public, because my goal was not to simply get through the moment, but to use the moment to propel us forward.
To look forward while still remembering the past. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for being with us today on VOA Asia. You may continue online. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd also like to thank our VOA Asia team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.